everybody. Oh, thank you. I'm a little bit weepy. Cause I love it here. This place is it's magical. And I guess you always have to have a place that you're sad to leave, right? It's an important experience in life. Don't do it too much though, that it'll mess up your everything. How about I read a poem that I wrote just before, it was maybe the summer before we left. You know how sometimes you know something? Like something's working in you even before it happens. We left here actually very quickly. It was surprising to all of us. For the first, I think, maybe 6 months after I moved to Colorado, I travel a lot and I would fly away and come back and my heart would just be like racing and my stomach would be sunken and I would just be like, I moved my whole family to Colorado. We left our beloved California. And then I realized that we live at altitude, and actually that was just physiological reactions to the altitude change. But also, against nostalgia. I suppose you have food there too, but here it is summer, and we have asparagus, avocados, and stone fruit. I am so happy. The yard trees of my youth yield more fruit than we can handle. I was going to bake chicken with cherries and apricots, but already it is too hot. I can't turn on the oven. Sometimes I bite straight into plums. Other times I slice them to serve on a platter. Sometimes I want to move away, so I must remember everything I used to love. Stone fruit and asparagus, drafts of eucalyptus carried through the window on the wind. I still hold that one of the things that's different about California and the Bay Area specifically is that breeze, right? We've got this eucalyptus coming through, you've got the ocean air. The rest of the country has to bottle that and like buy it at like Bed Bath & Beyond or something, right? And I know it's really expensive and difficult to live here, but like you get aromatherapy for free. It's just important. It's important to keep these things in perspective. Here's one more poem about my sort of coming back and forth from California. I was actually born in Colorado, but my family moved me to California when I was about 25 months old, and I've begun to reckon with why I have that very specific month number, right? Like I could just say two, but I say 25 months, like that extra month of Coloradoness made some sort of difference. So we moved to California when I was 25 months old, and I stayed there until I was 15 and then moved away, and then I came back for college, and then I moved away, and then I came back to work here, and I moved away, and I just keep thinking like this is my magnetic center, right? This particular spot of the world. And so this poem was written kind of thinking through one of those other periods where I was gone but coming back to visit. If I had a different complexion, my friends would joke that it's like right as my tan started to fade, I would have to book another ticket to California. Natural history. The rufous hummingbird builds her nest of moss and spider webs and lichen. I held one once, smaller than my palm, but sturdy. I would have told Mrs. Jeffers from Court Street if in those days of constant flights between California and Virginia, I'd wandered into that Oakland museum. Any chance I could, I'd leave my rented house in Lynchburg. I hated the feeling of stuckness that old city's humidity implied. "You need to stop running away so much," Mrs. Jeffers would say when my visits were over and I leaned down to hug her. Why, her words come to me, the woman dead for the better part of this new century, while I think of that nest of web and lichen, I cannot rightly say. She had once known my mother's parents, the whole lot of them, even then, in their 20s, must already have been as old as God. They were black. The kind name for them in those days would have been Negroes. And the daily elections called for between their safety and their sanity must have torn even the strongest of them down. Mr. Jeffers had been a laborer, the sort I regret I don't remember. He sat on their front porch all day near his oxygen tank, waving occasionally to passing Buicks and Fords, praising the black walnut that shaded their yard. She would leave the porch sometimes to prepare their meals. I still have her yeast roll recipe, the best I've ever tried. Mostly, though, the same Virginian breeze that encouraged Thomas Jefferson's tomatoes passed warmly through their porch eaves while we listened to the swing chains, and no one talked or moved too much at all. Little had changed in that house since 1952. I guess it's no surprise they come to mind when I think of that cup of spider webs and moss made softer by the feathers of some long gone bird. She used to say, "I like it right here where I am in my little house here with him." I thought her small-minded. In the winter, I didn't visit very often. Their house was closed up and overheated. Everything smelled of chemical mothballs. She had plastic wrappers on the sofas and chairs. Everyone must have once held someone as old and small and precious as this. So as I was writing this book, I was thinking a lot in both directions. I was thinking forward into the life that was going to become my daughter's, right? A future that would be my daughter's. And into the foundation out of which that future was based, which is the legacy of my elders. And then kind of what it meant to live in this space in between both of those pathways. The title of this poem is Conspiracy, which came out of thinking about what the definition of that word, the sort of original definition of that word, is to breathe together. Conspiracy. Last week, a woman smiled at my daughter, and I wondered if she might have been the sort of girl my mother says spat on my aunt when they were children in Virginia, all those acts and laws ago. Half the time, I can't tell my experiences apart from the ghosts. A shirt my mother gave me settles into my chest. I should say onto my chest. But I am self-conscious. The way the men watch me while I moved toward them makes my heart trip and slide and threaten to bruise so that inside my chest. I feel the pressure of her body, her mother's breast, her mother's mother's big loving bounty. I wear my daughter the way women other places are taught to wear their young. Sometimes when people smile, I wonder if they think I'm being quaintly primitive. The cloth I wrap her in is brightly patterned, African, and the baby's hair manes her alert head in such a way she has often been compared to an animal. There is a stroller in the garage, but I don't want to be taken as my own child's nanny. Half the time I think my fears are mine alone. At my shower, a Cameroonian woman helped me practice putting a toy baby on my back. I stood in the middle of a circle of women, stooped over and fumbling with the cloth. Curious George was the only doll on hand. So, the white women looked away, afraid I would hurt my baby, while the black women looked away and thought about not thinking about monkeys. There is so much time in the world. How many ways can it be divided? I walk every day with my daughter and wonder what is happening in other people's minds. Half the time I am filled with terror. Half the time I'm full of myself. The baby is sleeping on my back again. When I stand still, I can feel her breathing. But when I start to move, I lose her in the rhythms of my tread. There's a series of frequently asked questions in this book. The kinds of questions that people ask parents, mothers in particular. And I feel like some of them are like, were aimed at me particularly because I was later, made the decision to enter parenthood later in life, and I was had like this career as a professor and a writer, and it seemed like a pretty major pivot. And so it was a set of befuddlements, So one of the questions, the frequently asked question is, has your writing practice changed now that you've had a child? And this one is it difficult to get away from it all once you've had a child? Frequently asked question number 7. I am swaying in the galley, working to appease the infant who is not fussing, but will be fussing if I don't move. When a black steward enters the cramped space at the back of the plane. He stands by the food carts prepping his service. Then he is holding his throat, the way we hold our throats when we think we are going to die. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. He is crying. My God, what they did to us. I am swaying, lest my brown baby girl make a nuisance of herself, and the steward is crying honest man tears. Seeing you holding your daughter like that, for the first time, I understand what they did to us. All those women sold away from their babies, he whispers. I am at a loss now. Perhaps I could fabricate an image to represent this agony. But the steward has walked into the galley of history. There is nothing figurative about us. I feel like I want one of those note sections, like the expanded note section. For that poem in particular, because that trip was the first business trip I ever took with my daughter. And I had gone to judge the National Endowment for the Arts fellowships. And you know, she was 4 months old, but I could not take the opportunity to do that. And so I flew to DC. My sister, bless her, flew down from Vermont to help me with her. And I spent the 4 days in the old post office, which was the headquarters of the National Endowment for the Arts before it was bought by a certain Mr. Trump and turned into Trump Towers. And so I feel like having now like this extra kind of layer of that particular person with those particular politics embedded on top of my memory of this like historical trauma that is so much a part of who we've been as a country and where we are now seems to kind of add to me a level of kind of that, exactly that time travel in both directions that I'm thinking about throughout this book. So one more poem along this kind of multi-directional line, and then I'll move to a different project. One to watch and one to pray. We pass the baby over the bed, and later we pass tissue and her Bible with its onion skin pages, its highlighted lessons and dog-eared parables she kept handy with bookmarks whose tassels hung and swayed as her hair might have done when she was very sweet and very young. And when we had finished what reading we would read, we stopped a little while to register the pleasant song the woman on the stereo was singing. And then the baby cried for milk, and so we passed her back across the bed, which is when someone asked if there was any more water. And we passed the water over her lips with the swab the nurses gave us just for this, a square pink bubblegum lollipop looking deal, like the treats she used to give us when we were very sweet and very young. And someone came with roses. And though we smelled the flowers because we hoped for something better than the smell that lingered all around us, hothouse flowers look alive long after their lively smells have faded. So when someone came in with cards, we passed the cards and flowers over the bed and stood them up with the other cards and flowers on the little stand of white plastic and chrome that passed for a bedside table in that place. And when a friend came in who hadn't met the baby, we passed the baby over the bed and the friend said, "She's so sweet." And when a cousin came who knew things few of us knew, we listened to stories from when both of them were very young. And when someone cried, we passed the tissue over the bed. And when someone said, "She's so small now," we remembered the pink square bubblegum lollipop swab. And when the nurse said, "You can tell by how she breathes," someone got the Bible from the little chrome and plastic stand. And when someone said, "It's okay to leave," we didn't want to do a thing. And though several days later, someone told me people somewhere in West Africa pass a baby over the bed of a dying person to say there will always be new bodies to celebrate and mourn. That night, we only knew the baby needed a change, and someone had to take her. And so we passed the baby over the bed and decided who would stay to watch her go. Another project that occurred throughout this book was like thinking about what it meant to write into, major radical climate change and species devastation and et cetera, both what it means to live into that and what it meant to write into that. And so I have a series of Ars Poetica. This is Ars Poetica Apocalyptica. The boy walks me to the near edge of the purple horizon, past the last of the strip malls, past the dancing rebels, the food trucks, the penny saver girl. Keys bell his belt loops and pockets. Keys jangle his necklace, castanets in his small, calloused hands. The boy walks with me toward the bubble-roofed aluminum trailers and a horizon the color of plums. Keys sprout from the dirt at our feet the way it used to be with clover. I don't understand all the keys, so I ask. The boy squats to collect what the dirt has offered. Who can know what they will open? The keys have flimsy rings and illegible labels. They all look the same, though some of them are different. This looks like the key to my mother's car. A church key. The office? The boy collects keys from the shady earth the way we used to collect chanterelles. This might be the key to my house. At the near edge of the belligerent horizon, the boy turns a key over twice before he slips it in his pocket. Then he tosses a ring in the air, the way we once tossed tangerines. So now I'm going to flip to the book of essays. I'm going to read the end of an essay, and then I'm going to read one last poem, and then I'm going to, with great delight, sit down and listen to Javier read from his beautiful new book. It's a phenomenal book. It's a little tough to come out in a year with this year's class of books, because y'all have some serious business happening in poetry. So Guidebook to Relative Strangers, Journeys into Race, Motherhood, and History is my collection of essays that came out of like all that traveling that I was doing with my wee person. And it was just, it was honestly cheaper to take her with me all the time when she was just a lap child and she could fly for free when I was traveling than try and get childcare in the Bay Area. So she just flew around with me. But then I also became really interested, again, in this like foundation of this place where I was. And so this essay that I'm excerpting from, I'm reading the very end of it, is called Inherent Risk, or What I Know About Investment on Balancing a Career, a Child, and Creative Writing. And I have like the top part of the essay is just like, this is what I was doing, and it was insane and crazy, and I was like traveling 3 days a week and coming back and teaching Monday and Tuesday and then going out again. And meanwhile, I was sort of walking around literally looking at the ground under my feet and all the buried ships and buildings and foundations. And so I'll read a couple of these little underbars and then in the very end of this essay. Accommodation. When the Trans-American Building was first proposed, it was to be a rectangular, like the other skyscrapers, but the tenants of buildings around the old Montgomery block protested. They didn't want to be cut off from the Bay's legendary light. The tapered sides of the pyramid are an elegant accommodation, a way to allow the building to stand taller than any other, but with a slight shadow. I want to think about that sometimes as I construct myself as a mother. I want to be as big as I can be, but I aim to cast a lighter shadow on my daughter than some shadows I have known. Projection. At 853 feet, the Trans-American Pyramid is the tallest building in Northern California. When it was completed in 1972, the year I was born, it was the tallest building west of the Mississippi River. Designed to be a grand representation of a bold and influential world city. The scuttled ships and crisscross logs that stretched the city for blocks beyond the natural waterline were exposed again as the building's base was established. The pyramid would look taller if it weren't built on some of the city's most sunken ground. My father idled beside the Humanities Building at San Francisco State, where I would spend another workday. Bordered by native plants and accessible pathways, the five-story building rose above the campus surrounding it. I kissed Callie's forehead, trying to center myself in the pleasure of our last moments together, but her attention was drawn by my office building's glinting windows. Goodbye, I told my family, and good luck. As they pulled away, I remembered ascending the escalator at the Montgomery BART station during a trip into San Francisco. This was Tuesday, October 26, 2010. Callie was nearly 5 months old, and the Giants were doing really well in the series. Her whole body arched toward the long reach of sky. She was harnessed to me as I bore her along, her 6-inch trunk secured between my breasts. She was arching away from my body so she could follow the trajectory of the skyscrapers all the way to the place where their antenna tried to scrape the Northern California sun. We were on the way to City Lights bookstore where I was due to give a poetry reading, but she did not care about that. She wedged her arms and legs against my belly for support as she bent back, back, further back, mouth open in what looked like hunger. I'd been wearing her this close to my body all her life, and I never felt her exert a will like this before. I hadn't felt her work so hard to push away from me. Callie was looking at the tallest buildings she had ever seen, and she needed her whole self for the looking. And here's my last poem, which I want to read partly as a bridge to Javier and partly as an homage to all the people who do that, bend with their whole bodies to see something bigger and brighter and differently possible. This poem takes place out on Angel Island. I got to take a trip with a San Francisco State professor who'd done research on translating the poems that are there on Angel Island. So it was a pretty cool trip. What I know, I cannot say. We sailed to Angel Island, and for several hours, I did not think of you. And when I couldn't stop myself, finally, from thinking of you, it was not really you, but the trees. And not really the trees, but their strange pods, blooming for a while longer. A bloom more like the fringe fan at the tip of a peacock's tail than anything I'd call a flower. And so I was thinking about flowers and what we value in a flower, more than I was thinking of the island or its trees, and much more than I was thinking of you. Recursive language ties us together, linguists say. I am heading down this road. I am heading down this road despite the caution signs and the narrow shoulders. I am heading down the curvy road despite the caution signs and the narrow shoulders because someone I fell in love with once lived around here, right there. That is an example of recursive language. Every language. Nearly every language in the world demands recursion. Few things bring us together more than our need to spell out our intentions, which helps explain the early 20th century Chinese prisoners who scratch poems into walls on Angel Island, and why a Polish detainee wrote his mother's name in 1922. I was here, they wanted to tell us. And by here, they meant the island, and they also meant the world. And by the island, they meant the world they knew, and they also meant the world they left, and the world they wanted to believe could be theirs. The world they knew required passwords. Think of Angel Island Immigration Station as purgatory, the guide explained. He told tales of paper fathers, picture brides, the fabrications of familiarity so many lives depended on. Inquiries demanded consistency despite the complications of interpretation. In English, one would ask, how many windows were in your house in the village? How many ducks did you keep? What was the shape of the birthmark on your father's left cheek? In Japanese, Cantonese, Danish, Punjabi, the other answered. Then it all had to come back to English. The ocean is wide and treacherous between one home and the other. There can be no turning back, no correction, once what is said is said. Who can blame the Chinese detainees who carved poems deep into the wood on Angel Island's walls? Who can blame the Salvadoran who etched his village's name? Few things tie us together more than our need to dig up the right words to justify ourselves. Travelers and students, we sailed into the bay, disembarked on Angel Island. I didn't think about you. Which is to say, the blue gum eucalyptus is considered a threat, though we brought it across oceans to help us. Desired first for its timber because it grows quickly and was expected to provide a practical fortune. And when it did not, enlisted as a windbreak, desired still because it is fast-growing and practical, the blue gum has colonized the Californian coastal forest, squeezing out native plants, dominating the landscape, and increasing the danger of fire. I should hate the blue gum eucalyptus. But from the well of their longing, by which I mean to say from their pods, you know what I mean, I hope, their original homes. From the well of their longing, blooms explode like fireworks. I love them for this. Do you hear me? I absolve you. You are far too beautiful and singular to blame.